From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to Washington Watch on this Labor Day Friday afternoon. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. I hope you have something wonderful planned and you're able to take a rest from your labor as you spend time with your family and friends. Well, a major new study is out, and according to it, 470,000 people, the biggest subset of data yet achieved, was published yesterday in the journal Science and indicated that there is no one gay gene that determines a person's sexual orientation. In just a minute, I'll talk with Peter Sprigg, FRC Senior Fellow of Policy Studies, who's followed the issue closely and will share his thoughts. In my second segment, 20 million black babies have been killed since the egregious 1973 Supreme Court ruling in Roe versus Wade. And tomorrow, Saturday, August 31st, there will be a National Day of Mourning, and our own Patrina Mosley, Family Research Council's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, will be part of a historic march and prayer rally. She joins us in the B Block about the need to speak out against Planned Parenthood's black genocide in light of their placement of killing centers in minority neighborhoods across the country. At the bottom of the hour, yet another man has joined a women's sports team by claiming he identifies as a woman. This time, it's at the University of Montana, where a man at the U of M is going to be competing in an NCAA D1 championship women's 4,000-meter race. And I've got just a few thoughts on it. And at 42 past the hour, Indian-occupied Kashmir on the border with Pakistan is a new dilemma for America. That's the contention of my guest, Dr. Kanta Ahmed, a Muslim scholar with the Independent Women's Forum and a dual American-British citizen. She will join us live from London, England, to tell us why we ought to be concerned with certain activity in the region. As a reminder, go to TonyPerkins.com, the webcast site for today's broadcast. We have more resources, action steps, and guest information there. Plus, you'll find a link that you can share on your social media platforms of today's broadcast. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins, or me if you care to, at Sarah P. Perry. But we want to go to that groundbreaking study, and that's how I'll kick off the show today. 470,000 participants in this study. It was published yesterday in the Journal of Science, and the ultimate finding is that there is no one individual gay gene, which had been a subject of medical debate and some disagreement for some time. Genetics, along with environment, according to the study, do play a part in shaping sexuality, and researchers analyzed DNA from hundreds of thousands of people in this study. They found that there are a handful of genes clearly connected to same-sex behavior, but no one individual gene. The researchers said that although variations in these genes cannot predict whether a person is gay, these variants may partly influence sexual behavior. Joining me now in studio is our Peter Sprigg, Senior Fellow for Policy Studies, who has authored much on this precise topic. Peter, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah.
So both the New York Times and the Washington Post are putting a unsurprisingly liberal spin on the story, but really we're talking here strictly a matter of science. This is the University of Finland, if I understand correctly. And you've read the study. Is your holding the same as my assertion that there is no one individual gay gene? Is that your biggest impression from this study?
Yes, I believe that's the key takeaway. And I will say the media is acknowledging that. The study says that itself. But at the same time, I think there's an effort to sort of cling to the concept of the gay gene by emphasizing this sort of correlation or relationship in a broad sense between genetics and same-sex sexual behavior. But what the study finds is that genetic correlation accounts for at most a third of the variation in same-sex sexual behavior in the general population. Hmm. What does that mean? That means at least two-thirds of that variation is caused by things other than genetics. In other words, by social, cultural, or environmental factors. And I think the key thing is that for years, I mean, we're happy to have the science and to go where the science leads. I think it is the left that has been trying to manipulate science for years by implying or suggesting to people that there is a gay gene which determines that some people are gay, that the characteristic of homosexuality is something that is inborn and immutable mm-hmm. because it's genetically determined. That is not what this study shows, and it's important that even when you talk about something like genetic influence or a genetic link or correlation, that's very, very different from something being genetically determined. You did mention one of the findings there, I think, which is that although they find this link with the population as a whole, at an individual level, they said it is impossible to determine who is homosexual and who is not based on their genes.
Yes, absolutely. And Andrea Ghana, who was one of the lead authors here, and she is with the University of Finland, European Molecular Biology Laboratory Group, that's a mouthful, said that the research reinforces the understanding that same-sex behavior is simply a natural part of our diversity as species, which I'm going to take, as a Christian, I'm going to read between the lines a little bit, and I'm going to swap the term diversity for potentially deviancy. So in other words, there are, in fact, diversities as the left represents them, but as we represent them in a biblical understanding of inerrant truth, we understand that this is, to large extent, particularly now based on scientific evidence, a choice that an individual makes.
Well, I want to clarify that, because this is one of the things that's often thrown at us. We're accused of being anti-science. The left accuses conservatives of being anti-science. But I think the fact that they are concerned about this study shows that they're the ones who are really troubled by the findings of science. When it comes to sexual orientation, I don't believe that's a single characteristic. It's actually kind of an umbrella term that covers a person's sexual attractions, their sexual behavior, and their self-identification. And each of those three elements of sexual orientation needs to be examined separately. So we don't believe that people choose to experience same-sex attractions.
Correct.
But they do choose their sexual conduct, and they choose how to identify themselves. So, to the extent that the left is saying, oh, this doesn't support the idea that people choose to be gay, well, okay, that's fine. I don't claim that people choose to experience same-sex attractions, but they do choose their behavior.
Right. And I'm glad that you clarified that, because that is a critical point of distinction and what we have said, written about for so long. And it goes directly to the nature of what we believe as Christians and is backed by the scientific evidence. So we understand that. Now, there are 26,000 participants that the study identified who reported at least one sexual encounter with someone of the same sex. Now, they found 5 genetic variants that were statistically associated with these same-sex behavior. So what's the significance of these 5, what they call genetic variants?
Well, this is the interesting thing, is that even if there is this statistical correlation between these particular genetic factors and the same-sex behavior, it doesn't tell us anything about the pathway that would lead from having this gene to engaging in this behavior. For example, they say specifically that they did not identify any differences in cells or tissues that are created by this by these genetic variants. Now, that's different from some things. You know, the genes that give us blue eyes or red hair or whatever, there you have a connection between a gene and a cell or tissue expression of that gene. They couldn't find that in this case. So that's one thing that's important to realize. Now, I do want to mention the main measure they used, as you said, was whether somebody has had sexual relations with a person of the same sex ever, even once.
Right.
Now, I want to point out, that's probably the biggest methodological problem with this study, because the population of people who have had same-sex sexual relations once, at least once, is much larger than the population of those who consider themselves exclusively homosexual and publicly self-identify as gay or lesbian.
Right.
So, in a sense, that was the easiest measure for them to identify from these databases, but I'm not sure it's the most clear cut in determining whether people who identify as gay or people who are exclusively homosexual have a genetic connection with that.
Now, they also identified a pattern in multiple males within the same family who identified as homosexual. What do we attribute a pattern like that to?
Well, this is part of the issue, too. And, you know, I'm not a geneticist, so I'm struggling to understand these things myself. But they talk a lot about this concept of heritability. And but heritability, to a layperson, you hear that a trait is heritable, you think, oh, that means it's inherited. That means the gene causes it.
Right.
That's not quite what it means. It means there's some correlation between the genetic characteristic and the behavioral characteristic, but it doesn't mean that's directly inherited. I want to mention some other scientific studies that have been done. So they found heritability of same-sex sexual behavior was 0.32. But other studies have found that the heritability of conservatism ranges from 0.45 to 0.65. The heritability of right-wing authoritarianism, however they measure that, it ranges from 0.50 to 0.64. And the heritability of religiousness ranges from 0.30 to 0.45. So these characteristics, which nobody would ever say is inborn and immutable, nevertheless have quote-unquote heritability ratings that are as high or higher than the heritability of homosexual behavior.
Wow, isn't that interesting, including your religious predilections or your political preferences, both of which, I mean, you know my mother, we can say very, very clearly there is an element of heritability there. But that's such an interesting contrast, because they seem so distinctly oriented by choice. They seem so individually selectable, whereas for so long we've heard the term gay gene, and we think immediately that is something that will be passed down from one generation to another. Peter Sprigg has been our excellent guest here, a senior fellow for policy studies at Family Research Council. Coming up next, I'll talk with Petrina Mosley, who's on the road, and she will be discussing with us the National Day of Mourning to represent the loss of 20 million black lives since Roe versus Wade. We'll be right back to Washington Watch.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C. And learn how you can, too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday before Labor Day, and it's lovely here in Washington, D.C. I hope it is where you are as well. Just before the break, I was talking to Peter Sprigg, our senior fellow for policy studies, and in relation to this very extensive but a tad complicated study, he has written a blog up at frcblog.org. But we can also find this blog at our radio site, frc.org/radio, and at tonyperkins.com. So go visit the blog, read more about this particular study and Peter's analysis of it, because it really does have some fascinating insights. Well, Planned Parenthood has long targeted black babies and women under their plan of extermination called, I kid you not, the Negro Project. They have used abortion to advance the eugenic cause, and their efforts have resulted in the death of more than 20 million black babies. That's why Civil Rights for the Unborn, the Douglas Leadership Institute, and the Restoration Project are hosting a National Day of Mourning. It will begin with a processional in Richmond, Virginia, today, and will end tomorrow, August 31st. In Birmingham, Alabama, with stops in Raleigh and Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as Atlanta, Georgia. The day of mourning will end with a prayer rally Saturday, August 31st in Birmingham. Joining me now is Patrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy. Patrina, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Sarah. Thanks for having me back.
So I'm sure there are still people who are listening in the radio audience who are unaware of Planned Parenthood's very strategic decision to target black babies under a plan of extermination they called the Negro Project. Can you tell us about this piece of ugly history?
Sarah, can I? There's so much information out there that it's ridiculous, but I can condense it to a few sound bites. So Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, was also a leading eugenicist during her day of the early 1920s and 1930s and 1940s. She initiated what she called the Negro Project, that was an effort to implement her eugenic belief that population and heredity should be controlled by eliminating what she deemed as the unfit for society. Now, it wasn't just her, but this eugenic philosophy was shared amongst a number of American elites, such as Clarence Gamble, yes, of the Toiletry Products, Gamble, The Rockefellers were contributors as well, and a host of other names that can be found in the blogs that I've written at frc.blog.org about eugenics. So she's also very open with her beliefs and her plan for this eugenic philosophy in a number of her writings called Pivot Civilization and her founded journal called the Birth Control Review. Now, Sarah, she used a gimmick when she initiated this project to tell African Americans that you can gain access to the middle class if you let us help you control your fertility.
Ugh.
Then in 1942, she changed her American Birth Control League organization to Planned Parenthood to give the connotation of responsibility and freedom. So, get this, today, they have a dedicated Twitter account to the black community that has tweeted out to black women that it's safer for you to abort than to carry your child to term or give birth.
Oh, that is ridiculous anti-science, isn't it?
Ridiculous. So the gimmick has changed over the years, but as you can see, as I'm going to share with you now, the mission still looks the same. Over 80% of Planned Parenthood surgical facilities are located in primarily African-American Hispanic neighborhoods. Coincidence? Mm. I think not.
And in fact, this is part of the reason that these locations for the Day of Mourning were chosen during this historic march, because you will be passing through, for example, the Churchill community in Richmond, Virginia, the Cherry neighborhood, which is the oldest black neighborhood in Charlotte, North Carolina, and one in Birmingham, Alabama, blocks from the 16th Street Baptist Church, all predominantly black neighborhoods. So tell us, they are not all about profit. So as the march is kicking off, as this day of mourning is transpiring, give us a sense of how many black lives does abortion take compared to other leading causes of death?
Sarah, the leading cause of death for African Americans right now is heart disease, cancer, and accidental injuries. You take just those three, not even just the top five, which I calculated this in a blog that will be coming. You can even take the top five, but I mentioned the top three leading causes of death of the African-American community. It does not come close to the amount of black babies born and died. Well, I'm sorry, not born, died from abortion. Numbers don't even come close. Abortion is the leading cause, the highest number of deaths in the African-American community.
Now, we got about 2 minutes left, and I have to just talk about another abortion story, because we are going into this day of mourning, and your participation there is so welcomed by the individuals who are going to be there and on behalf of FRC, so we thank you. This article about a late-term abortionist, the infamous Leroy Carhart, allows his parents the chance to cuddle their dead child before disposal. Can we talk about how this is truly the madness of the profit-seeking cycle of abortion in the United States? He's probably taking a percentage of a profit for the photos that he takes as well. I mean, are you as stymied by this as I am?
I am flabbergasted. I can't even... Like, you want to talk about it, I don't even know where to start. But one thing does come to mind. One, you're right, this is about profit, but it also shows that we are in a spiritual battle. A lot of people believe that if we can just get a lot of the pro-abortion and see that it is a child, they will stop what they're doing. But this also shows signs this is a spiritual battle. They know exactly what they're doing, and they need their eyes opened by Jesus Christ.
Oh, thank you for framing it so well for us, Petrina. Petrina Mosley is FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, taking place in the National Day of Mourning this weekend. Coming up next, we have another transgender athlete, this time in college, this time at an NCAA Division I tournament.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. TonyPerkins.com is the website for today's broadcast. Find here on the website the blog post that I briefly mentioned in the last segment, as well as information about the guests and some reporting that we've accumulated. Now, I will never get tired of discussing this as a topic because it hits me individually as a woman. According to LifeSite News, a male college athlete who's pretending to be a woman, and I use that word distinctly and intentionally, is going to run in a woman's cross-country race this weekend. Based on his times while competing against men, he is likely to win, possibly in record-setting fashion, but let me tell you why. Because he is a mediocre runner. In fact, of his past 56 races, this individual, Jonathan Eastwood, who now calls himself June Eastwood, only won two of his past 56 races. And yet, even as a mediocre at best runner, he is still as good as the national women's track champion. I want you to think about this. So for a year, he has been allegedly suppressing his testosterone. And I say allegedly because the NCAA does not independently verify whether or not you have been suppressing your testosterone. In fact, as long as you have a doctor's certification, you could be flushing your medication down the toilet. No reading is actually given. For 1 year, he has done precisely this, and in that fashion has been able to now identify himself as June Eastwood and participate in the 4,000-meter event in an NCAA Division I track championship this weekend. Now, Runner's Online Journal, Let's Run, observed just earlier this week on Tuesday that his personal best on the track in the 1500 meter is 3:50:19. NCAA women's record for the 1500 set back in 2009 is 3:59:90, almost a full 10 seconds slower. This is a women's track record compared against a very mediocre, biologically male runner. He ran on the boy and men's track team until June 2018, but because there's not much you can do to counter your physical advantages, bone density, muscle mass, height, internal strength, of course, he will have an advantage. Expect, ladies and gentlemen, to read headlines on Monday that this individual has covered groundbreaking new territory in destroying all of his female competition, much in the same way as we've seen with women's powerlifting. And a certain individual who's been posting on Instagram photos of his very obviously masculine self holding aloft multiple trophies for smashing records that were held by actual women. I love what Fair Play for Women, a group that fights to protect women in the UK, said. Quote, males have a well-known physical performance advantage over females, and put simply, male bodies are bigger, faster, and stronger on average than female bodies. Female sport gives women the opportunity to showcase the very best of what the female body can do. In mixed competition, women would never simply win, and our best sportswomen would be unheard of. In fact, Jonathan Eastwood is a shade of a second slower than the fastest woman in the world. This is a mediocre runner, ladies and gentlemen. Two-time British Olympic women's champion Dame Kelly Holmes was extremely upset. She said, quote, meanwhile, in the U.S., middle distance runner John Eastwood will be running as June in women's races. Looks like we have another, quote, exceptional woman about to hit the track. Sorry, women. Time to move over, end quote. And I would add, yet again, the NCAA policy on transgender participation is inadequate. And let me remind you, the NCAA is fraught with its own additional controversies. And I give you the University of Michigan and Larry Nassar, for example. It does not have maximum testosterone levels. The NCAA does not independently verify. And there is no independent measurement of T suppression. So again, Jonathan, I use a full bold underline here because he is a Jonathan and not a June. Could be hiding his birth control pills underneath his mattress or burying them in the backyard for all we know. Once again, we find ourselves faced with the reality of biological, scientific, genetic immutability thrown in the face of the transgender movement, undoing decades of women's progress in sports, both at the high school and the collegiate level under Title IX. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, filling in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, Indian occupied Kashmir and the border with Pakistan is going to eventually create a possible problem for America. That's the contention of Dr. Kanta Ahmed, a Muslim scholar who joins us from London, coming up next.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christian's call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, Luana, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the garden tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, filling in for Tony Perkins. We're going to kick off this final segment with a bit of a geography and history lesson because we need to place our upcoming conversation within the proper context. We're going to be talking about Kashmir, a region of the northwestern Indian subcontinent bounded by two areas of China, by the Indian states of Himachal Pradesh and Punjab to the south, Pakistan to the west, and by Afghanistan to the northwest. And there is Kashmir right in the middle. It has a total area of about 86,000 square miles, but has been the subject of a dispute between India and Pakistan since the partition of the Indian subcontinent in 1947. Half is occupied by Pakistan, roughly half by India, and in the middle there exists an invisible line of control. The UN Security Council met recently in an emergency closed session to discuss Indian-occupied Kashmir for the first time since 1965. On August 20th, President Trump made this statement at the White House on the very complicated issue of that particular region.
Kashmir is a very complicated place. You have the Hindus and you have the Muslims, and I wouldn't say they get along so great. You have two countries that haven't gotten along well for a long time. And frankly, it's a very explosive situation. I spoke to Prime Minister Khan. I spoke with yesterday also Prime Minister Modi. They're both friends of mine. They're great people. And they love their countries. Kashmir is a very tough situation. This has been going on for decades. Shooting. I don't mean shooting like shooting a rifle. I mean like major shooting of howitzers, of heavy arms. It's been going on for a long period of time. You know, I think we're helping the situation, but there's tremendous problems between those two countries, and I will do the best I can to mediate or do something. They are not exactly friends at this moment. Complicated situation. A lot has to do with religion. Religion's a complicated subject.
So joining me now from London, England, is Dr. Kanta Ahmed, who wrote a piece for the Jerusalem Post entitled Indian-Occupied Kashmir, A New American Dilemma. She is a physician, author, and broadcast media commentator. Her work has been published in The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and Fox. She is the first physician and first Muslim woman to be awarded the Templeton Cambridge Fellowship in Journalism at the University of Cambridge in England. And in 2012, She testified to Congress on radical Islam in the United States. She is a graduate of the University of Nottingham and has practiced subspecialty medicine in the UK, the United States, and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. In December 2015, she was naturalized as an American citizen, and today she maintains dual British and U.S. citizenships. Dr. Ahmed, welcome to Washington Watch. We are happy to have you.
Good evening. Good evening from England. Thank you so much for having me. And the clip that you played of our president captures it. The key word he used there was explosive. And you gave a comprehensive geographical description for our listeners about this. But explosive is the word. It's very important to realize that India on August 5th took unilateral action in its parliament to abrogate an article, to erase a law that has existed since the partition of the countries that recognized Kashmir was autonomous, had its own government, its own legislature, its own parliament, its own flag, and even India could not subjugate it. That section has now become India-occupied Kashmir. The other part is Pakistan-administered Kashmir, and the line of control is between both. The reason it's explosive is this is one of the most heavily militarized regions in the world, and both countries, India and Pakistan, are heavy-duty nuclear powers. While India has much bigger conventional forces of the order of about 5 million troops, about 40% are on reserve, and Pakistan around a million troops, Pakistan outweighs India in terms of nuclear warheads, medium and short range. Therefore, the capability of Pakistan to retaliate to Indian aggression is enormous. Hmm. And under the new prime minister that President Trump hosted, he hosted Prime Minister Imran Khan at the White House, and President Trump surprised everybody by offering to mediate this very difficult dispute that it is equally sensitive to Israel and Palestine dispute, which people know perhaps much better. Right. I think that could have been the trigger for Modi to say, we're rolling in and we are annexing this part of Kashmir. That's something that China has not done to Hong Kong. That's something that Israel has not done to the West Bank. It's just beyond the pale. And there are many Indians inside India very worried about this, because this means the rest of India is nothing more than a loose federation of states. It's like the United States, but those states are respected as autonomous. That's changed now. If Modi can do this in Indian-occupied Kashmir, he can do it in anywhere else. India is no longer a secular, pluralistic, diverse democracy. It's turning into a Hindu nationalist supremacy. That's what's frightening for Indians.
So tell us a little bit about the dismantling of Article 370, because this is referenced throughout your article. We have read about this. We have heard of it. But for those who don't understand the significance of this particular article, can you tell us precisely what happened?
So at the time that the Indian subcontinent was divided by the last viceroy of India, Mountbatten, that was his task, to draw that line between what would be the new India and the nascent Pakistan. There was one state, Kashmir, which was Muslim majority, and it was not clear where that country wanted to be. The new Muslim state, Pakistan, is formed as a Muslim Zion. It was formed to be a protection for Muslims that would be a religious minority in the behemoth India. That was the goal of Pakistan to be formed. And so naturally, a Muslim majority population, one would logically think, would come to Pakistan. In fact, the Muslim leader of Kashmir at that time was worried to be part of a theocratic, Islamic, religious, non-democratic state that he was worried about, even though Pakistan was conceived as a democracy. And so he opted to align with India in exchange for having state autonomy, his own government, his own parliament, his own legislature, and one day there'd be held a plebiscite so that the people of Kashmir could actually vote. That was decided in 1948 and has never been held. There is nothing heard from the people of Kashmir as to what they want. And what's so shocking about Modi's actions is not just what he did in the parliament, where, as you know, there was a majority vote, but it's only a majority of five or six states out of 29 states in India. That's not really democracy. That's majoritarianism.
Right.
But a tyranny of the majority that decided that this law is now illegal under Indian constitution. Its own Supreme Court will challenge it. That's why there's a concern about it in Indian legislature of how it's done. But he immediately cut off the Kashmiris from the rest of the world. No cell phone, no landline, no television, no recording. There are in some villages in Kashmir, a soldier, an Indian soldier posted outside every small home. There is a curfew. People that are now beginning to rise up, and those that are rising up are shot. And some of them, the gunfire is aimed for their eyes, so they're being blinded. There's an incredible op-ed that all of your listeners should read today by the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, in the New York Times, describing some of these atrocities now happening. So this is really a shocking action for a democratic leader to take. But I think Modi, when he got reelected, this is a continuous theme in his political life, beginning all the way back when he came to the United States' attention in 2002, where he permitted Hindu supremacist riots against Muslims in Gujarat, murdering about 1,000 Muslims by the sword in his state where he was governor. And for that reason, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom advised the State Department of President George Bush to ban entry to Modi to the United States, and Europe and Britain followed. That ban held for 9 to 10 years, 9 years in the U.S., 10 years in Europe. That's who this prime minister is. Modi has been a Hindu nationalist supremacist of the supreme order. He follows an ethos called the RSS, and they are people who condemn Mahatma Gandhi, condemn Nehru, for accommodating to the desires of religious pluralism in India. That's what's so dangerous about this.
And to clarify for our listeners, there is a rise of Hindu nationalism in India, and there is patent and overt anti-Muslim hostility. So now in this area, there are thousands of Muslims who are terrified of retaliatory vigilantism, and for good reason. So we are seeing unprecedented attempts to effectively chill speech, quell any kind of democratic opposition. It's stunning to me, because as someone who had not followed this issue closely, the human rights abuses here are absolutely jaw-dropping.
Yes, I mean, I think that people don't realize, and that's why I am a child of what we call midnight children, those Indians that had to go to Pakistan because they were Muslim, or come from Pakistan to India because they were Hindu. So my parents were born around that time. And it's very hard to understand, if you are Indian or Pakistani, to understand how intertwined our nations are. If you ever go to the border called the Wagah border, which is world famous, right near Lahore on the border of Pakistan and India, there's a fantastic ceremony. They pull back the gates, and each audience looks at each other, and we look like each other's mirror images. We eat similar food. We can understand each other's languages. We have a common heritage. This was India always. And India has, even those, there was an Islamic civilization, Muslim rulers in India, that married Hindus and allowed Hindu temples, churches, and mosques to flourish in their centuries of rule. That's been the pattern of India. This supremacism of any religion is anathema to India. Now, inside India, there are 200 million Muslims, almost as many as there are in Pakistan, is about 193 million. So, yes, they are discriminated against. They're beginning to see that a little state subsidy for going to the religious pilgrimage to Mecca is being cancelled. There may be no marriages allowed between people that are Muslim and Hindu. There may be other sanctions taken against Muslims. This is really out of character for one of the world's most diverse, largest democracies. And there's a danger to this. Now, the dilemma for us as Americans and for our president is, if this goes uncriticized or unchecked or unsanctioned, it emboldens not only Modi, but us. If there are no consequences to just these irredentist policies where you reclaim territory that you believe in your imagination is yours, irrespective of the will of the people, any other superpower or power can go and pursue that. So it's very dangerous. My concern is our State Department might be favoring more India because they see India as a buffer against China. And China is hugely allied with Pakistan, heavily invested in Pakistan, has built a warm water port there, the Belt Road Initiative. And China at the moment is the quiet player watching all of this from an incredible vantage from that northern strip of Kashmir that it controls. So this is not something that is only going to involve two nuclear powers, but huge geopolitical forces. And as Americans, we are home to so many Indians and Pakistanis who are hugely successful in the United States.
Absolutely.
Hugely committed to their faith, but committed to the United States. Nikki Haley was the most incredible United Nations ambassador, and she is of Indian origin. And I think of the Sikh faith, which is also home in India. These are the people, this is who we are. We need to be able to thrive, and the Kashmiris deserve that. But Modi's actions are really beyond the pale.
So we have about 2 minutes left. If you could summarize what you believe our president must do, what would it be?
I think it's very important for the president to send perhaps Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to initiate at least direct talks with each power to find a means to de-escalate. This is now a tinderbox at the moment. Pakistan must not be left friendless. There has been a tremendous tension between the United States and Pakistan since the bin Laden raid, if you remember. But Pakistan has spent almost 15 to 17 years engaged in the global war on terror with the United States. Pakistan needs economic investment, and India is trying to sanction Pakistan financially and economically. That's got to be prevented. And Modi needs to face consequences. This is something that needs to be brought to a head. Maybe there are economic sanctions or other penalties. Modi needs to be made a pariah until at least the Kashmiris get back their human rights, their voice, their satellite communication. Their own politicians are under house arrest. This is unacceptable. But I feel
Dr.
confident
Kamata.
That our president, President Trump, is maverick enough to be able to have this kind of engagement with both leaders. And he is highly respected in Pakistan, President Trump. He's very, very popular, and he has a good relationship with Imran Khan. And I think that that could be a beginning.
Dr. Kanta Ahmed, Muslim scholar with the Independent Women's Forum, who wrote an excellent piece that I encourage you to read in the Jerusalem Post about how Pakistan and India are truly America's problem as well. Thank you for joining us on Washington Watch. While Western commentators are fearing that Pakistan's nuclear capabilities are large and significant, neither Pakistan nor India really wants to trigger a nuclear apocalypse. I think we all believe that would enshroud millions in Southeast Asia, but attention must be paid to a democratically elected leader who unilaterally invades another country. You've been listening to Washington Watch. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. We will join you next week. Happy Labor Day.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.